This podcast is powered by Tequila Fortaleza, handmade in small batches and hands down my favorite tequila.
Hey folks, it's that time of the year again. It is the Nora Mexican 1000. The Slow Baja Safari Class is your ticket into the happiest race on earth. We take the green flag every morning. We drive the best stages, but we've got a little time. We're going to stop. We're going to take photos. We're going to have tacos. We're going to take a little swim, maybe buy an ice cream cone. And we're going to get back across the finish line in time for a shower and get cleaned up and watch the racers come in. And then we all go to the big fiesta each night, have a fine dinner, and back at it the next day. It's 5 days to get from Ensenada to San Jose del Cabo. We start on April 30th in Ensenada, and we end up with a huge beach party May 5th, Cinco de Mayo at San Jose del Cabo. It is a major league adventure, and the Slow Baja Safari Class is your ticket in. For more information, N-O-R-R-A, that's Nora.com, or you can always message me through Slow Baja.
Hey, it's Michael Emery, and I'm so stoked to bring you this Slow Baja conversation. Just back from the Baja XL Rally, and Kaiser and I, my podcast producer Kaiser, got his first trip to Baja. Woot woot! We had an amazing trip, 3,000-ish miles, mostly on dirt, and we've got some great conversations to bring you, starting with today's. Today's conversation is with the legend, Ivan Iron Man Stewart. I've got a heaping dose of gratitude goes out to Carol Mears, wife to off-road Hall of Famer Roger Mears, rival to Ivan Stewart. They're friends now, folks. They are friends now. Carol confirmed that. But she connected me to Ivan, and she connected me to Johnny Johnson. I'm so glad that she did. We had a great conversation. Ivan invited us over to his house, and we got there a little late because we had some carburetor troubles in Slow Baja. But we got there, and he was gracious, and we sat down in the sun and had a conversation about his terrific career and his passion for Baja. And without further ado, Ivan Iron Man Stewart, the legend on Slow Baja. It's Slow Baja. I'm with the legend, Ivan Iron Man Stewart. I'm at your house somewhere south of San Felipe. I'm not going to tell anybody where you are. And we're going to get right into some big numbers here. Numbers. You've won 17 Baja 500s. Is that a record?
Yeah, I think it still holds today. Yeah, it's, Larry Rossler is pretty close to me, but he's raced on motorcycles and a lot of different classes. And all mine were, majority of mine were overall. So there's a lot of class wins, but I raced in trophy trucks and class one and all that. So most of mine were overall wins.
Ahead of motorcycles, the whole thing.
Yeah, well, those guys are hard. I beat them before, but they're hard to beat. I'll tell you, yeah, overall, yeah.
All right. Well, 2019, you were the first inductee in the off-road racing category in the Motorsports Hall of Fame.
In the Hall of Fame of America, yeah, that was really special.
You've got 84 career victories, 10 drivers' championships, 17 Baja 500s, 8 Mint 400s, 4 Parker 400s, 3 Baja 1000s, 4 score world championships, and you've been married for 55 years. Am I right on that?
Yeah, pretty close.
All right, well, tell me about Linda.
Great memories. Oh, yeah, Linda and I, we got married when we were 17 years old.
Is that your greatest career victory?
Yeah, really, it really is. Almost 60 years now, so we're...
Let's get back to that first race, 1973.
Yeah, that I raced with a high school friend of mine, a guy by the name of Bill Rinko, who's since passed away. But he had sold a house and had some money and said, Ivan, I want to go racing. We knew Lynn Chenneth and we knew Johnny Johnson, but we had never raced. And he said, I'm going to build a race car, a two-seat buggy, and why don't you help me with it, help me work on it, and I'll let you ride with me. So we did that for two or three races, and I just absolutely hated riding. That wasn't my cup of tea at all, to ride in an off-road race car. So one day before a big race, he broke his leg, and he called me and said, Ivan, he says, I can't make the race. I'll make the race, but I can't drive. You're going to have to drive the whole... It was an Ensenada 300-mile race in a little place called Santa Tomas. anyway, I drove it, and we won that race. And then the next race was like the Baja 500. He says, hey, you're doing so darn good. He said, just why don't you go start, do the first half, and then at the halfway point, I'll get in, and that way he'd get the drive, and I'd start. He didn't like to start. It was a lot of congestion and stuff at the start of the race. And so anyway, we'll be doing good at the halfway point. He said, oh, hell, just keep going. You know, we might win this thing. We did. We won the 500, and then we won more races. And so that was kind of the start of me realizing that. But I had more experience than a lot of guys because I raced go-karts when I was in the 50s.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
In the late 50s.
You were born in 1944. Do I have that correct?
45.
45.
Born in 45.
45.
So when I was about 10, 11 years old, 55 or thereabouts, they had races in Ensenada through the streets. I raced in Mexicali through the streets. I raced in Calexico, and I raced Ducati on the airstrip. So I had quite a bit of racing experience over a lot of the guys that were starting to race off-road. So I knew, you know, not so much about how to drive off-road, but I understood motorsports a little bit more than they did. So it became a little easier for me. And I think I always had a feel for it, just like my old buddy Johnny Johnson. I never seen anybody with a feel for off-road racing like he had.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
Still does.
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
To this day, you wouldn't be slow by a way, long ways.
Was your dad a racer at all?
No, I didn't have any. The only person I had in my immediate family was my oldest sister's husband raced jalopies in Balboa Stadium and some places like that. And I kind of I like that. And then Parnelli Jones was always a favorite of mine before we started racing, because he could race anything at Pikes Peak in Indianapolis, off-road, anything, he did it. So Parnelli was always a hero of mine that I had on a pedestal. I still do to this day. I mean, we're still friends, and he was one of the guys that, and Len Chenoweth. Listen to Len's stories, because he started racing just about a year or so before I did. So all those guys, Johnny Johnson, Len Chenoweth, Parnelli Jones, Walker Evans, those are the guys that were my heroes. And I just had to figure a way to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I got to figure out how to get into off-road racing. And that's about the time Bill Renko, the guy that broke his leg,
fell off a ladder.
Fell off a ladder and approached me to pursue it. Yeah, that's how I started.
So you're born in Oklahoma. Where'd you grow up?
Born in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then grew up in San Diego.
All right.
So East County, my wife and I both.
That's one of the best places to grow up if you want to be an off-road racer.
Place.
Yeah. All right. What brought your dad out there? What brought your family there?
Work. You know, there were opportunities to work.
Yeah.
Found a job where there wasn't much in Oklahoma at that time in the 40s and 50s.
And you and Linda, got married at 17.
Yeah, well, I was 18, she was 17.
That's the way you used to do it in those days.
Yeah, right.
And you had a good job. You're doing some fence working, if I have my notes correct.
Well, I worked in the fencing industry, commercial fencing, prisons, tennis courts, baseball diamonds, all commercial stuff. And I loved it. I mean, that was another goal that I had, and loved doing that, and that kept me in shape. So when it came to off-road racing, you know, I was in good shape being an iron worker and laboring an iron worker and being in that field that it was pretty easy for me to adapt.
Well, you start racing, you win your first race in 73. Do I have that correct?
Yep. Yeah. 73, so that was the Ensenada.
Bill breaks his leg, you win the Ensenada 300.
That's
you
right.
You get a pretty good payday.
But see, that was in a two-seat buggy. And at the time, if you were going to move up, you needed to go. It was kind of a pecking order that I started off in a two-seat buggy, and then I knew that I needed to move into a single-seat buggy, which was getting more recognition because I would win overall. And then, so I found, I drove a single-seat buggy and won some races, teamed up with Johnny Johnson a couple times, and build my way up to where I wanted to get into a truck, because I knew that it was either Ford, Dodge, Chevrolet, or Toyota. At the time, back in the 70s, you didn't even hear about Harley Toyota. I mean, that was just, people couldn't even pronounce it. And so anyway, I knew I wanted to get into a truck, so I got into a Ford with a Ford agency, a guy by the name of Coco Corral and his wife, then a Chevrolet agency in San Clemente that was Joe McPherson, drove his trucks for a while. And then we got Walker Evans to build me a truck. And then I started building a name and a reputation. I was starting to collect a lot of wins and championships. And then about 1982, Cal Wells called me and asked me if I'd be interested in driving a Toyota, which I told him no, I really had no interest because they only had four-cylinder motors at the time.
Wait a second.
You know, so yeah, now I'm going backwards. I don't want to do that.
You are synonymous with Toyota now, and it's funny to think that you might have not even wanted to be associated with them.
Well, yeah, because in the 70s to have a V8 was where it was at. That's about, you know, overhead valve V8. And I knew that Toyota was only building little import trucks that were, you know, what they call them,
fuel savers.
Yeah, fuel savers and four-cylinder motors
mini
and all
trucks.
That. And I didn't, what the hell do I want to race one of those for? So anyway, if you know Cal, he convinced me that, you know, horsepower to weight ratio, and you're going to go a lot farther with Toyota than you're going to go with Ford. And the more he talked, the more I started listening. So then I took a leave of absence from my job in San Diego. At that time, I was a superintendent of a big construction company there, a big fence company. And so I talked my brother into doing my job for just a year. I said, Don, I want to take a leave of absence, and will you do my job? And he knew how to do my job, and I never looked back. I kept on going.
So 10 years after that win in the 73 Ensenada 300, 10, mm-hmm. 10 years later, you're a factory-backed driver with Toyota.
It didn't go into factory. It was factory-backed.
Factory-backed,
But until you started winning and winning championships and they got the taste of winning, that's when they really started putting the money in. Then they built two trucks. Then we had a truck for desert and one for stadium, and then it went on and on. So, I mean, it was a progression. It probably took 3 or 4 years for us to get Toyota. And once you have Toyota, then the other sponsors fall on board. Once you get the big one, I mean, you get the manufacturer, then the tires and the wheels, the light companies, and all these people are, now they're putting money in it.
Yeah, after you win.
After you win.
After you win.
After championship.
You win, they're all throwing it at you.
Yeah, but it's not like a, you know, you just don't snap your fingers and those things happen. It takes quite a while.
And it wasn't set up by an agent. You had to go out and hustle, I'm assuming.
Oh, we had to hustle. Yeah, we had to go. Well, it was kind of fun because my deal with Cal was he paid me so much a year, and it got to be pretty lucrative about the third or fourth year. And then I'd get all the tires, all the stadium trucks, because they would only practice on one set of tires, and then they'd get rid of them, right? Because they wanted every bit of traction you could possibly get. And the same with, you know, I mean, I got a percentage of the cut of the winnings and the tires and a lot of, so I was making pretty good money there in the start in the 80s.
Can you dive into the difference between a desert race, a 500 or a 1000 or even a Mint 400 or something like that, and then the crazy Mickey Thompson entertainment stadium thing that you were the very forefront of that. You blew it up. They made a video game about you. You're that famous. Tell me about that. That's crazy stuff.
Well, I never considered myself very good at stadium racing compared to desert racing. Well, I mean, I can name you some guys that could lay down lap times just time after time after time, right within almost identical lap time. Rod Millen being one, but my teammate, but he had to drive completely different. I consider myself really good at taking care of the equipment and understanding when it was breaking and you know, what it was going to take to win a desert race. Stadium racing, you took all that stuff that you've learned in desert racing and it don't fit. You've got to just abuse the truck and, you know, practically tear the rear end out of it to win the races. So that was always, I never really liked doing that. I was a little bit leery of tearing the equipment up because the next weekend I'd have to do a Baja 500 and take care of the equipment and still go fast. But it was quite completely different. But I knew that stadium racing, where it's going to be for the future of me, for me to stay involved, it wasn't going to be just desert racing because it was too hard to televise, too hard to tell the story. But in a stadium, it was easy. You had cameras, and everybody was all in one spot, hotels and all that stuff. So it was difficult. And I think anybody, I don't know if Roger Mears would tell you the same thing, but it was difficult for me.
I want to know the toll on your body. It must have been something.
The secret was, once you've done it for very long, you know, Johnny Johnson would get in your vehicle, and he'd take a drive for 3 or 4 blocks, in a rough road, he'd come back and say, we got to change this, 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 and this. Where you don't know that. You don't know it's going to give you blisters on your back until you get down about 300 miles down there that the seat's not set up right. or the brakes are not right, or something's not right on the car. Where he was just really good at analyzing that. So if you once you knew how to, the car should be, the race car, then that's what you go for. But a layman comes in, he don't know until he hurts himself, right? That he doesn't know the seats are wrong, the steering's in the wrong position, the shoulder belts are way too tight, or whatever it is. So all these things you have to learn. So the longer you do off-road racing or off-road driving, you'll learn. The tire pressures are too high. In fact, yours look too high to me, but go ahead.
I haven't aired down yet. Oh, okay, no, you're good. Absolutely right. I mean, I've been on the highway, and I need to drop about 15 pounds right now before
okay,
I get out
so
of here.
You know that, but a lot of people don't even know that.
Yeah, well, I put it on 25 when I get here, but I had a rough day yesterday, and I haven't done my work
yet.
All right. I even appreciate you saying that, because a lot of people would just say, well, I'm not going to tell this guy what to do. He knows what he's doing or whatever, but I do appreciate you saying that.
But it holds true with everything on the car. So, I mean, the seating position, how the brakes work, the throttle hanging up or whatever it is, you got to fix it.
So I've talked a lot about, in my own personal life, I did the La Carrera Pan Americana, and that's where Bill Strop, you know, in the 50s.
You did that also?
I did that in the 2000s, yeah. So I did that in an old 53 Lincoln and a little Datsun.
Was it a speed event?
High speed, dangerous as
I mean, Mickey Thompson did that too, Bill Strop.
Yeah, so, you know, that was when it was a real race. I did it as a vintage race, but it's a high speed, very dangerous 2,000-mile vintage car race. And the fastest guys are doing the 180. They've since changed it that the limit's now 140 miles an hour, but the fastest guys were doing over 180.
Jeez.
When I did it on public roads that are shut down in mainland Mexico.
At least they shut them down, because they don't used to shut them out down here. They used to race with the traffic on the roads, on the highway.
What I was going to get to is Bill Strop. And in your life, I mean, Bill was before you a little bit. Who had the best backside? You were talking about Johnny Johnson being able to analyze problems, Cal Wells. Who had the best backside to be able to feel what's wrong in a car?
Johnny Johnson.
And then set it up.
Bar none. Johnny Johnson. Because he was a mechanic, and he was probably the first guy I've ever heard of that would take shocks apart. He wasn't afraid to take them apart and be one step ahead of the competition with valving or whatever he was, extra reservoirs, whatever he wanted to do to them. But yeah, he was amazing at analyzing problems, and that's what it's all about. I mean, whatever, especially a race down here, you have to analyze. If you smell something, there's a reason you wasn't smelling a mile back. You better think about it, what it might be, or feel a vibration in the steering. It could be, you know, anything.
What did you say on my way in here? These problems don't usually fix themselves?
No, they don't. No. I was going to tell you the story about the...
Let's get to that.
You want to hear that story now?
Yeah, let's get to that.
Yeah, this was the last Baja 1000 I won in the year. I think it was 2000. In fact, it was in the year 2000. Well, I didn't have any problems whatsoever racing down the peninsula until I got about three quarters of the way down below Ciudad Constitucion. And it was dark, and the throttle started sticking. But it didn't stick wide open. It was about half throttle. You know, it didn't, because wide open would have been 600 horsepower. In a few seconds, you're going to be going a lot faster than you want to. But it would hang up, and I'd kind of fiddle with it, and it would come undone, and finally, we stopped and tried to fix it, because once it does that to you, you don't have trust in it anymore. You know, so you don't have faith that it's going to, maybe it might stick wide open instead of half throttle. So anyway, I stopped a couple times. They tried to fix it. And a friend of mine, Larry Ragland, was the guy coming behind me. That was, if he could pass me, he would be leading the 500 or the 1,000. So anyway, we stopped the last time, and they kept trying to fix it. And they said, hey, Johnny's right behind you. And he stopped. I was stopping the pits, and then he stopped right behind me in his pits to get gas or something. So I took off. The thing's still hanging up. I didn't go another 10 miles. I quit doing it. And race cars never, ever fix themselves like that. I found out later it was one of the butterflies in the fuel injection had come loose, and it would flop over and hang up a little bit. But yeah, that's the only thing. Because anytime if you're down here, for your audience also, you're down off-roading and something's wrong, you better analyze it, because it'll really let you down. Then you when you really have a problem, you could have fixed it 2 miles behind you, you know?
Here at Slow Baja, we can't wait to drive our old Land Cruiser south of the border. And when we go, we'll be going with Baja Bound Insurance. Their website's fast and easy to use. Check them out at BajaBound.com. That's BajaBound.com, serving Mexico travelers since 1994.
Hey, we're on. We're back. We took a little break. We're back in Ivan Ironman Stewart's garage.
Yeah, this is my old Baja garage. You don't throw anything away down here. That's why there's crap on the walls and everything, because if you don't need it, somebody else might.
Well, I had a nice chat with your friend Roger Mears. We were just talking about Roger and Carol, and Carol was so kind to connect us. And tell me about the people that you worked with, raced with, raced against. Pick out a couple of really good unsung heroes and shed a little of the Ivan Stewart magic on them. Tell me about folks you really liked.
Well, there was probably,
and
probably
why you liked them.
Parnelli Jones was probably the one that I really admired, because he could race anything. He raced Indianapolis, Pikes Peak, off-road, on-road. And
Trans-Am.
Yeah, oh, you name it.
Sports cars.
Yep, sports cars, you name it. And he was always a... You know, when I got to know him later on, he was retired, actually, when he got into off-road racing. But he's just a man's man, a guy that could do anything. You like him, everything. You know, whenever you have somebody on a pedestal, anything they say or do is okay. He told the story one time, and I'd hear these stories, and they always ring true, is he had a journalist with him one time just before the start of the Baja 500. Maybe 1,000, I don't know. And it doesn't make any difference. And the journalist says, "Hey, Parnelli, just out of curiosity, how do you know the fast cars from the slow cars?" He says, "Oh, it's easy." He says, the fast cars have got the great big bumper on the front. He says, "The slow cars have got the bumper on, big bumper on the back," which is the truth. I mean, there's no doubt. And then another time, this was in the 70s, I remember a journalist asking me, he says, "Parnelli, you won this race. Now, you started, 150 cars were in front of you, and you passed every one of them in that 500 miles to get back here first. Where'd you pass them? How'd you do it?" Parnelli would say the same thing. The only thing you really could say, he said, "I just passed them where I caught them." And I thought that was the coolest thing, and what a great answer, you know. How else are you going to do it? You can't pass them where you don't catch them.
Well, the two things that feed my passion about traveling down here, one side of the TV when I was a kid had a big cabinet, and it was all road and track magazines.
Yep.
The other side of the TV was another cabinet, and it was all National Geographic magazines.
Mm, yeah.
And I remember reading about Parnelli, and it was the 1970 Trans Am season. And I think he'd already sewn up the championship. And he had a lot of problems, and the car wasn't running right, and he should have just stopped and not competed. And I don't know if it was his determination, or if it was a unkind remark from somebody or something, but he, and again, I'm sorry, I'm going back to high school, so 30 something years ago, when I read this article, and the magazine was already 10 years old when I was reading it.
Right.
But basically, he decided to take this battered, beat up, not right car and say, "I'll show you F's," and took it from the very back and banged his way to the very front and won, and he didn't need to.
Yeah. That's how I've heard other stories.
He did it out
of
grit and determination.
Another guy told me, that funny you tell me that story. This is a different story, but it's the same type of deal. Partly on the starting line of one of the Trans Am, or maybe it was a NASCAR race, I don't remember, a road racing course. And his mechanic was telling me, this was only about 4 or 5 months ago, he's telling me, "Sorry, Parnelli's sitting behind the wheel and he's just gritting his teeth." You know, and it was probably the same, might have been the same story, but he says that Parnelli had been having trouble and stuff, and he says, "I'm going to pass these guys in the first, I'm passing every one of them in the first lap." And he did it. In the first lap, he was leading the race again. That determined, just that focused. And but yeah, he just anything he did, in my opinion, was pretty. And Mickey Thompson also was a. Mickey Thompson really helped me a lot in the early days.
Can we go into a little bit of that?
Yeah, he. You know, I was really terrified of these things and the camera and you know, and public speaking and all that. And he knew that I was gonna, I just got in the ride with Toyota, and he knew a lot of things were gonna come that I didn't know anything about. You know, TV commercials and public speaking and all these things.
Video games.
Video, all the everything. And yeah, everything that transpired, you know, after he, well, mainly because he started the Mickey Thompson series. That's, desert racing wasn't getting that much publicity. It was just Cal Wells convinced Toyota to go desert racing because he had all these mechanics in the big shop. If we're going to do stadium, let's do desert too. And Toyota bought into it. But yeah, Mickey convinced me to do some Dale Carnegie classes and public speaking and just. He'd take me off the side. I remember one time Lynn and I were having lunch with him, and he told Lynn, he says, well, if Ivan ever starts believing the stuff they write about him, he says, you kick him for me, will you? And she kicks me every once in a while, and not so much anymore, but yeah, great. You know, I was really had some. Cal Wells was another one. I mean, he was absolutely amazing at putting deals together and getting the right people and engineers and pitting people. I don't know how he did it. He had 50 people working for him, and all good, dedicated engineers that, boy, I tell you what, they'd, you know, they'd work all night, all day for him. And but it was a great period, a great time, and to be in off-road racing when the, you know, it hasn't come back to that. Factories haven't got in since Toyota's been in, nothing that I know of. So yeah, it was great to be in part of that, part of the history of that form of racing.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because again, you were really at the forefront of that. And can you talk a little bit about Sal Fish and his devotion to making off-road into something?
Yeah, if it wasn't for Sal, I mean, desert racing surely wouldn't be where it is today. I don't think that he put a tremendous amount of his life into it. You know, and for years and years and years, you know, just dedication. I mean, when you think about what he did and the people he had to work with, all of his competitors, and not all of them, but a majority of them had a lot of money. You can't go off-road racing without a lot of money. And a lot of them didn't want to hear the word no. They wanted everything done their way. So, I mean, he had to go overcome a lot of obstacles that were tough. And, you know, I don't know how many people that I've talked to said, well, I wouldn't have his job for nothing, you know, just way too many problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, people getting killed on the racetracks, and then he'd get the course all marked out. Then they'd have a, you know, flash floods, and you got to go up and change the course. And I mean, on, and I could tell you stories about that too. That just, you know, no way I'd be wanting to put a race on.
But as many leaders of industry and people who were heads of their companies and what have you, who had the dough to do this, he also, I think, had to keep it real for the carpenters and the plumbers and the guys who are stringing fences, to let them have their class 11 or whatever, their opportunity.
Well, that's why there's so many classes, because you have to cater to all of their wishes. So everybody, well, I'm going to build a Baja Bug with three wheels on it? You know, well, he'd say, well, if you get enough people together, I'll give you a class. I don't know if he ever turned anybody down. You know, he'd give you whatever it was, because that was part of his business too, was entry fees, and try and keep the other promoters from having your competitors. That was the main thing.
Well, you've raced a lot of races.
Mm.
Do you have any? Has Dale Carnegie helped you figure out why you're more successful than others?
No,
I mean, not quite as successful as Johnny Johnson, but
yeah, you know. Right.
But not to needle you, but what do you attribute all the success you had? Was
well,
it the
I'll tell
machine?
You,
was
in a funny mentality? Way, in a funny way, is being lazy. And the reason I say that, because before I got into off-road racing, I worked in construction, right? And so when I got a taste of off-road racing, and maybe the taste that I might be able to make a living at this off-road racing, I didn't want to go back to construction anymore. I'd had 10 years, 14 years of doing that, and I didn't want to get back. I mean, that would be like moving back. So I had, I shouldn't say lazy, because I worked really hard at being, I wanted to be the most professional, win the most races I could, look the best part, act the best part, could do an interview better than Roger Mears or do more autographs than, but I'll tell you another one. I think so being lazy is that I figured out real early that Mickey Thompson was going to make us do these autograph sessions, right? Before the race, you'd have a whole stack of autographs on the hood of my truck, and then Rod Millen or Steve Millen or whoever my teammate was on the other side. But I can see Roger Mears was down here, Walker Evans is over here, and all this stuff, right? So being competitive, I wanted my line of people to be longer. So I did one thing that you'd never figure out what I did to get my line to be quite a bit longer. So what I would do is every time I'd sign my name to Margaret or Bob or Bill, and I'd put all the best wishes, you know, whatever, and then I dated it, 1983. Every signature you see of mine has got a date on it. So what would happen is later on, about the second or third year, I'd get people in my line that had been in my line but 2 years ago, but they wanted an 84. Be sure and date it, Ivan. I want a 19. I got an 83 and an 84. Date it this way. Pretty soon, I have more people in my line than even. They don't think anybody ever did figure out what I was doing.
And it took you a lot longer. You're just writing a dissertation.
Yeah, well, what happens then, too, the longer your line gives, even if people don't know you, they figure you got to be somebody.
It's got to be something good.
Yeah.
You better line up.
But just dating the autographs was, that's little things like that. And being competitive and trying to do a, you know, win races, win more championship, do a better interview. That's. Keep Toyota happy. That's the answer to your question.
And we've talked a lot about your career, and you've had an amazing racing career, as a kid who graduated high school in 1984. There are few people as legendary in the world of off-road racing in that period of time as you were on TV, at the video arcade. People are playing the game at the pizza parlor. I mean, it's an amazing thing to be sitting here in your garage. Enough about that. Tell me about why you're living in Baja part of the year. Tell me about Baja. Tell me about the people, the places you support, the charities, where you and Linda have spent your time, and why you keep coming back.
Well, I think probably the adventure of Mexico. And once you've learned how to deal with Mexico and how to get across the border and what kind of paperwork you need, and when you get down here, if something happens, it's just like an off-road race. You know, when you have a problem in an off-road race, the quicker you solve it and make a decision on what it is and how quick I can solve it. What's the same thing in Mexico? If you get stopped by a cop, you have to make a pretty quick decision. Should I try and bribe this guy or shouldn't I? Or, you know, or how much should I bribe him or whatever it's going to be if you have it get broke down. And so it's just all those, I think it's the adventure of trying to figure out how the easiest way to get from, like I told you earlier, that I've never had a bad trip here. And the reason being, I've always made it back. But I've got a ton of stories. And, you know, for almost every story you can tell, I got one that's going to be as good as that, or maybe a little bit better that happened to me. You know, from people pulling guns on me and I don't know. It goes on and on and on, breaking down. And in the I used to start pre-running from Ensenada to San Felipe, and I knew that my pre-runner didn't have enough gas to make it. Because I've done it 2 years ago, the same pre-runner, it won't make it. But everybody that pre-run behind me always carry gas. So I wouldn't be out of gas for 5 minutes. So you got to be first on the road. So you got to get up early in the morning so you get all the people behind you. If you got the people in front of you, you got to help them, right?
So that's a good way of looking at it.
Here comes somebody. Hey, I got 5 gallons. Give me a couple gallons. I'll make it to San Felipe. But all those things, just fun stories that, you know, and the friends that I've met, not only the competitors, but the locals, the people, because you what you really want when you're going down through here, and the closer you can get a friend, when you break down, you want to be as close as you can. If you don't have any friends from here to La Paz, ooh, that's not good. You need a phone number or something, you know.
Well, I tell you, I had a problem at the end of the Nora 1000 first day, and my San Felipe guy directed me to a shop, Chavo. He's working in his yard, and got to see Chava. And what am I thinking as I'm driving down here with my problems? Well, as soon as I get to Chava's, it's going to be fine. He'll sort it.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That type of thing. Or when you get close to Roger Mears, he may not be a mechanic, but I'll guarantee you he knows somebody that can fix a distributor on that thing.
Like Kurt LeDuc says, I got a guy. If I can't fix it, I got a guy.
I got a guy. Yeah, that's what you got to have.
Hey, so you've done a bit with Linda, helping the locals, supporting some charities. Can you talk about that? Tell me a little bit about. I don't know if you want to or not.
But I'm proud of.
You've been very generous.
Well, for about 10 years, we took a group of motorcyclists. you know, I don't know. I know we've donated over $100,000 to this little deaf school in Ensenada. You know, and that was just something every year that we'd do a motorcycle ride, and they'd put a presentation on for us for these people that ran this deaf school. It was all on faith, a faith school. And that was fun. And then I've been down here before and building houses. You know, they asked me to, you know, you can contribute your time to come and build a house. In fact, I'm going to build another one in June, I think it is. You just donate your time, and they have a slab already poured, so you help them put the walls up, and you paint it, and the windows in, and all that stuff, and it takes about 3 days. And that's always rewarding. You know, that's always a lot of fun. So I'm going to do that again, like I say, this June. Then you know, always something you can do with the schools and autograph sessions and that stuff and fun things. But it's kind of fun to give something back once in a while. You have to do that, I think. And this place has been awful good to me, all of Baja up and down.
Well, there's a lot of places you can live near the dirt where if you want to go out in your buggy or something, you can do that in Arizona. You can do that in California. Yep. You can do that in Utah. You can do that in a lot of places.
Yeah, yeah.
Why are you here?
Like I said, I think probably I keep coming back to the adventure. That's why I wanted to race down here, is because it wasn't as much as of the race as it was the adventure. You know, because everybody I talk to, they come with all these great stories that they broke down and they had a horse pull them out of the ditch. And really, you're kidding. They had a horse. Yeah. Let me tell you, pal, if you get stuck in a ditch, you better find your horse because they'll pull pretty good. But, I mean, those stories just never, ever end. And everybody that's raced down here are very long. They've always got, you know, all these stories how they got involved in something. And I ran into three guys that were naked in the desert. Here's a good one for you.
I was just going to say, you got one story that stands out? You got starting with three naked guys in the desert.
This is a good one. So Johnny Johnson and I and Frank Arciero, another friend of mine, were pre-running. Actually, it was north of San Felipe up in the mountains back there. So we're pre-running, and we see some activity, some movement way up the wash. Something's going on. And this was like in the middle of the week, like a Wednesday. Right? So Saturday or Sunday, you see more people pre-running, but in the middle of the week, not that many. Most people have to work. I was fortunate we didn't have to work. So there's some movement up there, and what the hell's going on, you know? So somebody ran out in front of us, and pretty soon we get closer, and we realize the guys are naked, like three guys, right? And we're thinking the same thing everybody thinks when I tell us, this is going to be a hell of a story. What's behind this? Well, so as we get closer, I'm thinking, well, you guys are probably a bunch of Mexican guys that are drugged up. We're going to take a wide berth around them and just keep on going. I don't want to talk to them. And Johnny Johnson, I remember Johnny Johnson thought, he said, hell, they're probably skinny dipping out here someplace. There's a pond out here. Maybe some girls. Let's stop and see, you know. That'd be Johnny Johnson, right? And I forget what Frank Arciero thought. He thought, well, what actually happened is these guys were pretty new to Baja. And they had come down on their motorcycles and pre-running. I don't even think they were racing. They were just doing it for the fun of it, right? And they were supposed to have a truck come off of the highway and bring them gas. And they're at a place called Tres Pozos. And, there's not a sign on the highway. If you don't know how to get to Tres Pozos, it's about 10 miles back in there. And if you don't know how to work, there's not a sign, a flashing light, flashing sign that says Tres Pozos this way. So anyway, they missed their gas. And they're out there for like a day or two. I forget the whole story now. But anyway, they pooled their gas. They put all the gas out of one and put it in one bike. And the best rider was going to ride out to the highway. And hopefully that's where their chase truck was going to be now, right? Fuel and come back and get them. And he rides, and this guy tells the story. He says he rides about another 10 miles and he doesn't get to the highway. He runs out of gas. He says, I walked all night long to get back to these guys. He said, you know, I wore my helmet. And he says, every once in a while, I'd get down on my hands and knees. So we're questioning him. He said, you know, so what? Why would you get down on your hands and knees? Well, he says, it was dark. And he says, that in the middle of the road, there's a crown, right? He said, I'd get on my knees, hands and knees, to make sure I didn't get lost. I'd feel for that crown with his helmet on. I said, well, why would you wear your helmet? He says, well, because there's coyotes out there, and I'm afraid they're going to chew my ears. I'm thinking, you mean you've got no clothes on, and you're worried about your ears? So anyway, we ended up getting them all. They were, and it was really hot. That's why they took their clothes off, because it was getting too hot. And they've been out there like 3 days now without any water. They were getting ready to attack some cactus, and they told us, we laugh. Anyway, that's another Baja story. You know, I haven't had too many people top that one.
Yeah, I don't know if you can top that.
Did Johnny tell you that story?
He did not.
He did not yet.
He did not tell me that story.
And that one was really funny. I can't believe how many times I've run into people down here. Here's the perfect example. One of the guys there had a lot of money. I mean, he was very wealthy because you ever seen those knee braces they wear? They're like carbon fiber. Like if you have a bad knee, you know, they strap it here and they strap it here, and it's carbon, really high dollar. He invented this thing. And remember, in fact, I was just thinking about this the other day. He invented this deal, and he said, you know what? You guys saved our lives. He said, we're going to fly you to Las Vegas, and we're going to put you up in a great hotel, buy you the best dinner you ever had. I'm telling you, we're going to, give me your phone number, right? He never called us. Never heard another word from that guy. But you'd be absolutely amazed how many times this happened to me where somebody's going to do something and they talk about, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, I'm going to really take care of you. You never hear another word.
I'm going to have you on the Slow Baja podcast, and the guy doesn't show up for hours.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, Ronald stuck in his car when they were leaving Chenna's place.
Well, Ivan, you've been a heck of a good sport about all this. I really appreciate you making some time for me. If you had one piece of advice for somebody who's coming to Baja on the first trip, they've only read the bad stuff, what would you tell somebody?
I tell everybody the same thing all the time. I always have is, come down here with somebody that's got more experience than you do. Somebody that kind of show you the do's, the don'ts. If they speak Spanish, that's even better. But somebody you can tag with, because you shouldn't be traveling too much, especially at night, you know, by yourself. So, I mean, that's, come with somebody that's, and listen to everything they're telling you, what they've learned. Because they've learned a whole lot, probably. You don't want to get hurt down here. You know, the farther down you get, the worse it's going to be to get you back.
And yeah, we saw a horrific accident. Unfortunately, the guy fell asleep at the wheel and didn't roll his truck, but went off and crushed.
North of San Felipe.
Yeah.
So anyway, a lot of that happened. Yeah, just, you know, learn as much as you can. Read the books, all those things. The more and more knowledge you can get, you know, the things that, you know, I've done over the years, and luckily I've got out of it. But, you can save yourself some agony. But as long as you get back, it'll just, like I say, it'll just add up to your Baja stories, right?
Add up to your Baja stories, right? Well, I think we're going to leave it right there.
Cool.
Well, I appreciate you making some time.
All right, Michael. Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me on your show.
Well, I think we did it.
Good.
Hey, I hope you liked that one with the legend, Ivan Stewart. So cool to just be sitting with this guy who's done so much. And thanks again to Carol Mears for getting us connected. If you like what I'm doing, I'm going to ask you, and I'm really seriously asking you, take a second, help me out. Go to slowbaja.com, drop a taco in the tank. If you're on Patreon and you're supporting folks doing this fun stuff, if you check me out and add me to your supportees, I'd greatly appreciate it. I really would. New carburetor rebuild on Slow Baja on the way home from the Baja XL. First tank of gas, 6.77 miles per gallon. It was uphill. There was a headwind. It was on the highway, but that's a lot of gas when you're driving in 2,000 and 3,000 mile loops around Baja. So need some folks to drop some tacos in the tank if I'm going to be able to continue doing this stuff. Rate the show, share the show, Spotify, Apple, drop a 5-star, tell people why you're still listening, all these shows later, why you're still listening. And to wrap it up, to paraphrase Mary McGee's pal, Steve McQueen, Baja's life. Anything that happens before or after is just waiting.